All right, our clerk will call the final case.
The court will now call Damian Lamont Mercadot versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Kenneth Gordon and Mr. Danny Burns will argue for the appellant. Ms. Andy Porter will argue for the state.
Thank you. Damian Mercadot was convicted in Criminal District Court Number 4 of capital murder, either as a principal, as the shooter, or as a party, or in some way as a co-conspirator. The state waived death penalty, and he was given an automatic sentence of life without parole. At the time, Damian was approximately 18 years and I think 3 months old. I'm not waiving any points that I have, but I'd like to proceed on a couple, and then Danny Burns is going to speak on a couple that I think are important. I submit that the Texas statute 37071, as it applies to a child, and an 18-year-old is a child, is unconstitutional. It's cruel and it's unusual punishment not to allow a young person, a child, an 18-year-old, to show some evidence of potential rehabilitation, some evidence that would warrant the chance of perhaps making parole at some point in his life.
What's the status in other states? Do other states, or do you know, or Andy, do you know, do other states have automatic life without parole for 18-year-olds, or do they have a higher age before you hit the life without parole?
I don't know for sure on other states about automatic life without parole, like our statute. I know that the states have written on being 18 years and above being eligible for life without parole and the death penalty. And I don't know if Andy knows or not.
Because they just held that it was unconstitutional for a 17-year-old to be hit with life without parole. And that had to come from someplace, and I'm assuming it came from other states who did not have that the cutoff at that point. So are there states that have a higher cutoff than 18, or is 18 pretty much accepted across the United States? Because apparently that does matter to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Supreme Court has held that you can't give death penalty to any person under the age of 18. They have not said that life without parole, an automatic sentence, is cruel or unusual. Well, the Supreme Court hasn't said it's cruel and unusual. Texas has not said it's either cruel or unusual. My position in this case is simply that the brain has not matured. Chronological age does not equate to maturity. The fact that the earth revolves around the sun 18 times or whatever does not show a person is mature, understanding of the consequences, and doesn't realize that when you're killed, you can hit the reset button and start all over again. Life without parole is the second most stringent punishment that can be imposed. Death penalty is the most severe, but being locked up in a cage for the rest of your natural life, in my opinion, would be the most severe. It doesn't give
Mr. Gordon, was the constitutional challenge raised in the trial court?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Specifically in appellant's motion number 38 and in the objections to the charge and everything else. Yes, specifically. And it's my position that when you do not permit some evidence to show the potential for rehabilitation, the potential that in 20 years or 30 years, this person would be allowed back into society as a changed person. In an automatic life without parole, the person is the convict is not permitted any kind of education, because why? The people who are going to be released get that. There's a reason why the military likes to induct 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, because they're so much easier trained. I've been there. I know that. I was in combat arms. They're easy to train, and they're easy to train to kill. without remorse, without compunction. And if it's illegal for a child to not have a drink of alcohol until they're 21, and if it's illegal for a child not to buy a pack of cigarettes until they're 21, why is it legal to lock them away for the rest of their life at 18 if they don't understand or comprehend the future, the consequences? And I submit that in this case, the only evidence was Damien's written statements. That's all they had. The fact that Polly, the actual shooter, the admitted shooter by the state, who actually pursued and shot and killed this young man, was tried and convicted and got 20 years for aggravated assault, seems to me to show that, in fact, this is a cruel and unusual punishment to give this kid life without parole when he did not fire a weapon. He went to pull a burglary. Stupid, yeah. Understand the consequences? No. Did he have an opportunity to withdraw? The minute that Dominique Jones got that gun and got climbed back in the car, his perceived ability to say, I don't want to go, ended. Because he didn't have the chutzpah that Dominique Jones had.
You mentioned in your brief there was an attempt to warn the complainant of the burglary.
Right after the text conversation between Damien and Dominique Jones, Damien, in his statement, said that he sent a text to Daniel Clerkey, Garner, Daniel Flippa Garner, hoping he wasn't home. He just said, what you doing? He didn't specifically say, leave the house. In his statement, he said, I thought that Polly was trying to get in my head. I didn't think he really was going to shoot and kill Daniel Garner until he did. And Dominique Jones opened that front door, went into that living room where Daniel Garner was standing playing a TV game, and started shooting immediately, and pursued him from the living room into his mother's bedroom, fired 7, 8, 9 times, and hit this kid. I know of 3 front entry wounds and at least 2 back entry wounds.
20 years for ag assault.
I'm sorry?
20 years for ag assault.
That's correct. That's what he got. He kept his mouth shut. And they would not have had a case against Dominique Jones had not Damien Merkeldove given the statements, had not Damien taken around to show them where the stolen property was, which was in the homes of all of Dominique Jones' family and friends. That's where everything was found. That's where he took them. They took pictures. He initialed the pictures. That was one of our objections, but in our brief. But it's my position before you that a child is a child. 18 is not mature. 18 does not understand fully the consequences of life, much less what you're doing. If you can't smoke or drink until you're 21, how come you can be given this kind of a punishment 3 years earlier? I think it's cruel and unusual. I think it should be declared unconstitutional. And that's what I'm hoping this court will do. Danny is going to speak on a couple of other constitutional points, with your permission.
Really, the Supreme Court has ruled, Your Honor, that giving of a child under 18 life without parole is unconstitutional. It is cruel and unusual punishment. And they didn't set a specific block there. But here's the question. Can we really say that Damien Merkeldove received the due course of law when he was sentenced to the penitentiary at the age of 18 for the rest of his life for an act he didn't commit, an act he didn't necessarily know was going to be committed, and didn't need to intend that it happened? And yet he's supposed to die in the penitentiary because somebody else committed the crime and he happened to be there. And that's one of the problems with this 70 I think 702B or 704B.
702.
Just two. That, you know, somehow we have a conspiracy without a conspiracy. And I submit to the court there's no legal justification for that. How can you be a conspirator when there's no conspiracy? The jury is not required to find that there is a conspiracy. The jury is not under that instruction. Even the trial judges realize that that instruction is just nonsense without some sort of guidance. And they try to give guidance where the statute says there is to be none. Either it's a conspiracy, in which case it's an offense lower than the one that was actually committed, than the offense that was committed, or it's, you know, required to be a part of a conspiracy. And they have to give instructions on how to guide the jury in that. They're not told what a conspiracy consists of. They're not told that they have to have an agreement. And if this particular act is outside the agreement, then he can't be convicted of that under the conspiracy.
There doesn't have to be an agreement to be guilty as a party.
As a party, that's correct. But as a conspirator, there has to be an agreement.
Right. That's why it's one degree lower, because all you have to do is enter into an agreement. They're totally different offenses. At least that's what this court said in Broski. But
the problem with that reasoning and thought is that once you're going to convict somebody of a conspiracy, as a conspirator, without telling the jury what that amounts to. You know, a party, you have a party. As somebody aids, abets, encourages, wants this thing to happen. I don't have a problem with convicting somebody under that theory. I have a problem with an 18-year-old getting life without parole, but the problem comes down to when a conspirator, the jury is specifically told he may not know it's going to happen and he may not want it to happen, and yet he's going to be convicted of something that somebody else did, and he's going to get life without parole for what he didn't do, for something he didn't do, something he didn't know was going to happen, and something that he didn't even want to happen. And he has no ability in this case, or in this kind of a capital case, to be able to show any mitigation, to have any mitigation applied toward him. That cannot be constitutional. It's a violation of due process. It's a violation of due course of law. And I would ask this court to so find and to reverse this case as being a unconstitutional sentence, cruel and unusual. Thank you.
Before you sit down, there's a question I'm going to ask Andy, and y'all might want to think about it. Before McCormick and Montoya held that 702B was the law of parties instead of conspiracy, was there any case that had held that?
I've never seen a case before that one came coming out saying that conspiracy is actually just a part of parties. And I don't know of any legislative indication to that effect.
Andy, you're not old enough to know. Before Montoya, which was a McCormick opinion, 702B was criminal, was, you know what it's the title of the statute is, criminal responsibility for the acts of the other. A, you were guilty as a party. B, you were guilty as a co-conspirator. And in Montoya, McCormick announced that 702A and B were both the law of parties, not the law of parties and the law of conspiracy. And my question is, was that the first case that ever held that, or was there some authority for it? And if you don't know, that's okay, because it's a long time ago. You weren't even alive then.
I may please the court. Thank you, Justice Stefano. The only case that I'm aware that might even come close is English versus State. It is cited in the state's brief. It's at 592 Southwest 2nd. 939, and that's a 1980 Court of Criminal Appeals case. I don't think It directly addressed.
After Montoya, I think.
Montoya was in 1989.
Was it 89?
Yes, ma'am.
That light? Okay.
But I may be wrong. English may not answer your question, and I honestly think it doesn't. And I'm aware of no other case that we've even come close. With the court's indulgence, I will go ahead and address the 10th issue first, that being the propriety of Article 37071 of the Texas Constitution and automatic life without parole. After the parties had filed their briefs in this case, the Fifth Circuit did have an opportunity to address this very issue. And that case is Doyle versus Stevens. The docket number is 12-700-25. Was issued by the Fifth Circuit on July 10th of this year. It was not selected for publication by West, but in a footnote 3, the court notes that the appellant is arguing, bear with me, I want to use the court's own words. The appellant in that case, and it was a capital murder case that came out of Dallas County that's on habeas review through the Fifth Circuit, and the defendant was 18 at the time he committed the capital murder. So he didn't fall within Miller versus Alabama, Graham versus Florida, any of those cases. But he was arguing on habeas that really the Supreme Court was talking about in Miller versus Alabama is a developmental maturity or a developmental age, really trying to argue it's a sliding scope. And the Fifth Circuit rejected that argument outright. They said, no, Miller versus Alabama is all about a categorical approach. 18 is the line. You're above the line, you're eligible for the death penalty. You're below the line, you're not eligible for the death penalty.
Does it state what the basis for that line at 18 is?
It goes back to Roper versus Simmons, which is the case you're probably most familiar with, and where the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the developmental age of the development of the death penalty over basically several decades. They went back to the 1940s to look and see when the last time somebody under the age, I believe, of 16 had been executed. It was 1948 that they talk about in that case. And they looked at how the death penalty had changed over the succeeding decades, the states and their individual approaches to the death penalty. Some had gotten away with the death penalty completely. Others had said, okay, only those above 16 now are eligible for execution. Incrementally, some of those said only above 17 are eligible. Incrementally, only above those above 18 are eligible. And finally, in Roper versus Simmons, they said there's been enough sea change that we can say, you know, this is the cutoff now. And they based it on some psychological studies, the change among the state legislatures, the trends across the nation, as well as, the infamous references to foreign courts of law and the opinions that the foreign courts had on the death penalty itself.
That's why I was asking about 18 for an automatic life sentence. Where the other states stand on that?
And I haven't done the research on that. I know that there are some other states that say life without parole at 18 is acceptable. I know of no states that say 19 above or 20 or above or 21 and above. But I won't discount that possibility, but I'm aware of none. But I know that there are other states that say 18 LWOP is okay according to the legislature, and that's a legislative determination. So
what about not informing the jury of the sentence, the only possible sentence if they find him guilty?
And in this case, the statute you're talking about doesn't say that the trial court must be the one to inform them. It just said that the prospective jurors shall be informed.
Yeah, but the jury charge says you are bound to receive the law from the court and be governed thereby. The jury charge tells them to ignore the lawyers.
Correct, Your Honor. But my understanding of his point of error had to do with prospective jurors means during voir dire.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't talk about the ultimate jury charge in the jurors that's selected.
My question was the fact that the judge doesn't instruct them, I mean, at any point.
Well, but I believe that's a different issue than the issue actually raised. I may be wrong on that.
Well, I often ask about different issues than the ones actually raised.
Well, for the question that you actually asked, I don't think there's a statutory requirement that tells the judge during guilt innocence, you shall instruct the jurors on the potential punishment range during guilt innocence, because it's not then law applicable to the case. Punishment range only comes up when you get to the punishment trial. And at guilt innocence, it's not law applicable to the case. So there's essentially no reason at that point in time to do it, absent statutory instruction to do so. And in this case, the statute says prospective jurors, but it doesn't say who has to inform the prospective jurors about the possible consequence of a capital murder conviction when the death penalty is waived. In this case, the record has several instances where the parties themselves informed the jurors during voir dire. And if you'll bear with me for just a second, that occurred in volume 5 of the record at pages 23, 25 through 28, 31 through 32, 75, 88, 90, page 124, 133, and page 160, where there were conversations between the lawyers and the prospective jurors about the consequences of life without parole.
All right, so Texas has jury determination of punishment, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you request a jury trial. You request a jury on the entire trial, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, so you know where I'm going.
Yes, ma'am.
What's the answer?
The legislature's determined for certain categories of punishment, that being capital murder in which the death penalty is waived, that a sentence of life without parole for those who are 18 or older is the appropriate sentence, and that's a legislative function. I hate to be flippant, and I really
don't. I understand that.
I don't mean disrespect to the court.
Florida's legislature also had their idea about what a jury trial meant. So are we going to see some instruction to the state of Texas about jury trials, and if you have a jury trial for punishment and you request a jury? Are we going to see the same thing Florida got about the Apprendi ring, that whole line of cases?
As it stands right now, I'm aware of no legislation to that effect. There are certainly some people across the state who've encouraged the legislature to take up those very issues. They declined to do so this last time, but I have no idea what bills are floated across the state. I agree with you. There are some issues and there are some problems, but I'm aware of nothing that's addressing your concerns. With respect to the first and second issues, that's having to do with the application of the jury charge that actually included three different application charges authorizing a conviction for capital murder. The first one was authorizing capital murder conviction as a principal. The second application charge authorized conviction as a party. And the third one is the one that the appellant is really complaining about on appeal, and that has to do with incorporating some conspiracy language, adopting some things from 1502 and 702, or maybe 1501 and 1702, and kind of mixing the definitions together. The long and short of it is the jury returned a general verdict, so we don't know which theory among the several the jury actually chose, whether they convicted him as a principal, as a party, or as a party that it adopted some of the language from the conspiracy statute.
Or whether they convicted him as a co-conspirator.
Correct. However, in this case,
punishment.
In this case, the application charge didn't authorize a conviction for criminal conspiracy. It authorized a conviction, the application paragraph number 3.
Under 702B with conspiracy language from 15, and if there's a question, which by now you figured out I definitely have about 702B, being the law of parties when that's not what the statute says, then they were instructed they could convict him as a party or as a principal or as a co-conspirator, but still the punishment was going to be the punishment for the greater offense, not the lesser offense, which isn't even a lesser included offense of the greater.
Actually, if you read the jury charge very, very carefully, and I invite you to actually dissect it, diagram it out if you love your eighth grade English class. But the complaint of explication paragraph actually authorizes a conviction because Dominique Jones murdered Daniel Garner during the execution of the crime that was the object of the conspiracy. And it's that point right there. It's the object of the conspiracy. It was carrying out that object crime. So as long as Daniel Garner was murdered,
requires an agreement.
Yes, ma'am, but the agreement is separate from the execution of the crime.
No, the agreement is an element of conspiracy.
Yes, ma'am.
Agreement is not an element of murder as a principal or as a party. Therefore, I mean, there's so much case law that says conspiracy is not a lesser included of the great of the subject of the conspiracy.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And yet the instruction was that you could convict him as a conspirator.
Except the actual wording of the instruction authorized his conviction as a party for carrying out the object of that conspiracy. The conspiracy happened much earlier in time. Then they executed that conspiracy, and the execution of that conspiracy resulted in Daniel Garner's death. And it's what happened during the execution, because those are two separate moments in time. That's the capital murder conviction that the jury charge authorized and that he was convicted of. And so that is acceptable. They're actually, the English case that I spoke of at the very beginning, 592 Southwest 2nd, 949, that's the Court of Criminal Appeals.
49 or 39?
I've written down 949. I may be wrong, Your Honor. I apologize.
I thought you said 39. I'm sorry.
If I'm, well, I've got it written 939 to, it's either 939 or 949. I apologize.
No problem.
But it's the court in that case very closely analyzes the difference between criminal conspiracy, and if it's the carrying out the object of that conspiracy, then the conviction is a party, even if you include the conspiratorial language in the application paragraph. That's okay because it's the what happens as a result of executing that conspiracy that authorizes the capital murder conviction, and that's acceptable. Another case that's unpublished from the 14th Court of Appeals, and I believe it was cited in the brief, but I won't swear to that without my brief in front of me, was Beck versus State. And the Westlaw site is 1986 Westlaw 10156, and that's out of the Houston 14th. And the court also addressed very, very, very similar language to the application paragraph actually used in this case, and there's really no distinguishing the two. So, and they were both found acceptable. I believe my time is running short. With respect to the remaining issues, we'd rely on the state's brief and submit that there's no reversible error in this case and ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Rebuttal?
Thank you. In rebuttal, state law says that the trial judge shall give the jury the law, and that whatever the trial lawyers say is nothing. In 44 years, I've never been able to get around that. The trial judge has the obligation to tell the jury what it needs to know. And the trial judge has the obligation to tell the jury, or prospective jurors, that the punishment for capital murder, when the death penalty is waived, is life without parole, because that will affect how they think and what they say and how they react to any question, whether even can be on that type of jury. CDC 4 did not give that instruction. Never, ever.
Yeah, but whether they can be on that jury is a voir dire issue. It's not a jury charge issue.
That's correct. I'm just saying is that the judge failed to give the prospective jurors the law. Now,
but,
there's a sister.
But the jurors were aware. The jurors were made aware of it through voir dire and through counsel's questions to the jurors, correct, at the places in the record that Mr. Porter indicated?
That's correct. And there's a sister court in Houston that has said that if anybody, and I guess that could include a bailiff, tells the prospective jurors or tells the jurors that life with that capital murder conviction where death is waived is life without parole is sufficient. But that seems to abrogate the place and position and authority of the trial judge. The judge is the person who must give these jurors the law. That's what a jury charge is for. And I think that, and submit that, by failing to do that, Judge Thomas failed to comply with the rule. The fact that somebody else, including trial and defense counsel, may have said, life without parole, capital murder with no death penalty is life without parole. That's not the judge. That's not the law. They were not given the law. They could not think about it. My last point on rebuttal is, yes, there was a general verdict, but we don't know whether the jury convicted Damian Merkeldove of capital murder as the shooter, capital murder as the watcher, or capital murder as a co-conspirator. The court gave those separate charges. The court told the jury the term conspiracy means an agreement. An agreement constituting a conspiracy may be inferred from the acts of the parties. He didn't tell them that if you find this defendant guilty of conspiracy to commit whatever, the punishment range is, I don't know what the lesser included of punishment range for capital murder, life without parole would be. Murder with a determinate sentence or so, I don't know. But we don't know. We don't know why or how or we don't know. And that's a jury charge. That's a failure of the judge to give proper instructions, to give them a roadmap to travel from here to wherever. And I think that's a failure, and I think the case should be reversed because of the error. And I think it's constitutional error. Thank you.
Mr. Gordon, thank you. Mr. Porter, thank you for your arguments today. They've been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and we will be adjourned.